Commander Rappard, Reel 32. Now, we're talking about your role as, well, as anti-submarine officer and as press officer in these...
A fleet task officer and the press officer. The press officer bit was something brand new to me. I took advice and found that I had no choice between the newspapers. If they'd been accredited, then I had to accept they were properly accredited newsmen from whatever country they came from. The problem was to keep them from finding out the things which were meant to be secret. And that problem is exacerbated by the fact that the Iron Curtain countries quite clearly called pressmen people who were trained intelligence officers. And when they knew approximately where these exercises were going to take place, we have to accept that the fleet was shadowed by Russian trawlers, in inverted commas, and factory ships, in inverted commas, whose rails were lined with people with huge lenses on their cameras, and which had aerials of a full variety and were quite clearly trying to intercept all our signals. And it was a very interesting business. I spent a certain amount of time thinking one jump ahead of this and trying to keep them away from the things they were trying to discover, and at the same time given the impression they were being briefed. So when they wanted to go on deck and see something, I might can't say there was going to be a press announcement down below. And it added to my knowledge of how the world worked. Mere naval officers were pretty green as grass about things like that. But it did give me a chance to go around the world into various parts of the world I hadn't been to before in a different role altogether. And the different role was absolutely fascinating for me, because in the Mediterranean, I was flown out to analyze an exercise called Dawn Breeze, which was an East Atlantic exercise, I think in the following year, well, after my appointment there. And I stayed with friends at Gibraltar. And I think, I'm not certain whether I have told the story about being in the French aircraft carrier when the Admiral's staff and the French aircraft carrier were discussing what they would do if the rebels in North Africa succeeded against the government. And it turned out they were, the story went something like this. This huge Atlantic exercise and Mediterranean fleet exercise led to a wash-up, which was an analysis of the exercise taking place at Gibraltar with both our Mediterranean fleets, the Toulon fleet, and the French Atlantic fleet with a carrier group and submarines from all over the place with American aircraft and the lot. And my role, I had 3 days at the end of the exercise in which to analyze what had actually happened in the anti-submarine part of the warfare, which had stemmed from way up in the latitude of England to down south of the Mediterranean, the Atlantic end of it. And I knew from the records I'd seen and from the fact that I'd been to sea partly at one time in a Dutch carrier, I knew the French hunter-killer group of a carrier and a few destroyers had made a total pig's ear of what they were meant to be doing. So I was very interested to get the facts from the records kept on board the ships in accordance with the exercise orders. And the Frenchman refused to hand over any records to me so that I could analyze the exercise. Well, my commander-in-chief was Admiral Philip Vian, who was not a man who minced words with anybody and had had a very famous war. And I had to go along to him and at a vin d'honneur aboard the flagship when the French admiral was there as well, and said, "Excuse me, sir, I have a problem. I've got to deliver this analysis in 36 hours now, 48 hours, and the French won't send their records in." "God, boy," he said, "must be a damn mistake." "No, sir, sorry, there's no mistake. I'd be grateful if we could have a word, perhaps, with your opposite number." So with great tact for him, he said that he understood that the things have been held up in the post or whatever it was, and he'd be very grateful. And the French admiral was charming about it. Of course, that could be arranged and no problems at all. And he sent his chief of staff to fix it. And I was sent off with the chief of staff. And an extremely bad-tempered French captain was produced who was obviously refusing to give it to us because he didn't want to seem a bloody fool in public. And it took another 24 hours to extract the bits of paper. So I had no sleep for the final 24 hours and produced the analysis and said, I'm not going to read this analysis in front of 200 or 300 senior officers in the cinema locally. This must be read by the French people themselves who took part in the exercise. Do you agree? And they said, no, it was all a mistake. It was not our fault. These facts are all wrong, etc. So I had to go back to the head man. And the captain, who was refusing to do it, was relieved of his duty by the French admiral. And another man was told to do it, and he duly did it. And I was invited to have dinner with the admiral, the French admiral, and his staff, particularly his staff. I think the admiral was present. In their carrier, the Aramarche, alongside at Gibraltar. So we went down, and a monumental lunch party took place where the wine flowed freely, and to my astonishment, the French admiral's staff were arguing among themselves as to what they would do if the Pieds Noirs in Algeria were revolting, and indeed it was accepted by the French government that these people could behave like that. And they were discussing whether they would mutiny or not, not to put too fine a part on it. And excitement raged, and Gallic voices were raised, and I didn't understand half of it, because my French is not fluent, so at least it. When somebody came in and said something to the chap in charge of the lunch, who looked at me and said, we are going to see, you must go now. And I found he'd underestimated that we had in fact slipped all the ropes. We weren't secured to the beach at all, alongside. The ship was gradually being pulled out by tugs. I was invited to stand on a crane hook, and the crane hook reached over the edge and put me on the jetty just as the bit of wire was beginning to pull out a bit. So it was a most extraordinary experience, something which could not have happened in the Royal Navy. Not a matter which was ever written down for public consumption, as I would imagine at the time. But it always made me slightly dubious as to how keen on NATO the French actually were. And my time at Northwood left me with no answers to that question at all.
There's a very good story about when you were transferring from ship to ship and you'd lost your trousers. Or
I was at one stage during an exercise, certainly I was based upon a Dutch carrier, which in fact was called the Karel Doorman, and had been handed to them by the British. It was a British carrier which had been bought or sold to the Dutch. And the man who'd married the Dutch queen was flown on board during that time. And I lived in the wardroom, but he lived in the wardroom too, to my surprise. So I found myself having, what's his name?
Prince Bernhard.
Yes, Prince Bernhard. I found myself often having a meal beside him and learning to enjoy Dutch food, which is not sort of bacon and eggs for breakfast or anything like that, but very curious things indeed, which I put up with enjoyment. But my role there included checking on how the exercise was going. And in order to do that, I was allocated a helicopter. And I flew in the course of one day. I made 9 different transfers by helicopter to different ships. On one of them, a British destroyer, we were out in the Atlantic, and there was quite a swell, so the ship was going up and down. And I was being lowered down by the winchman of the chopper. And the pilot of the chopper was trying to time his rise and fall to match the movement of the ship that I was being transferred to at the after end of it, nowhere near the foremast, thank heaven, but there was a bit of a mast right aft, not much of one. And as I was coming down onto the deck, there was a young sailor there who was trying to steady me to get me on my feet on the deck. And the ship fell away underneath him. The helicopter didn't follow it down quick enough. And the young sailor decided that I was disappearing to the moon or something, so he hung on to my trousers. As the ship fell away, the chap was still hanging on to my trousers. My braces parted, and I was floating in the breeze over this ship in my pants, nothing else at the after end. And the next time, we got it right, and I got down to the deck, and the message came from the captain that he would appreciate seeing me in his cabin right away. And he said, "My dear chap, I am so sorry. Have a drink." And I got my trousers back, and somebody sewed my braces together again. But it was entertainment for everybody. It was no doubt fairly hairy from time to time. But one got used to the idea of doing this. But I would have preferred to have two engines rather than one. I always had a preference, because there really isn't much leeway if one engine fails under those conditions, and you'd get the helicopter landing on top of you anyway.
Now, the other story that was part of, we actually had earlier, which was of the time you gave a lecture on anti-submarine tactics, and then were offered a position with an American admiral, and then you had all the trouble afterwards. And you've now remembered that that was actually during this phase, not during the earlier phase.
Yes, I was so doing that as part of the Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic staff through my Eastland job at Northwood.
And so we if people want to hear that, that's about three or four reels earlier.
Yes,
they can find it from the catalogue.
Part of their fund.
I'd like, what about, a bit more about these journalists, Iron Curtain journalists. How did you cope with them? I mean, they can't always
fall. I'm not a linguist. I knew a certain amount about the intelligence work because I'd had an intelligence job, you remember, before HMS Belfast. And I knew, therefore, a great deal more about the way in which these Iron Curtain countries operated than perhaps most naval officers. I wasn't allowed to talk about any of that, but I was aware of the lengths to which people would go to obtain information from us. But I could not give away how much I knew, because that would have made me a target. As it was, I was just an officer dealing with the press without any particular background knowledge. Whether any of them had checked on the previous appointments I'd have, I don't know. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if they hadn't tried to. The way I dealt with them, therefore, was to deal with them in groups and to lay down very strict rules, and then have quite clear reasons why those rules were there, without actually saying, "We're not going to let you photograph that thing, it is taboo," because that immediately attracts the attention of anybody who wants to take photographs of it or whatever. It was one requiring great tact and without any doubt giving one the opportunity to put both feet in it occasionally. Luckily, none of my events led to further scenes elsewhere.
What about your personal security and the precautions you had to take yourself? Because you were travelling about a fair amount as well.
I was not allowed to travel the other side of the Iron Curtain for some 12 years after leaving my job as the Commander of Procurement in the Naval Intelligence Division in the Admiralty. And I didn't. And I didn't go to embassy parties or anything like that. I wasn't invited to embassy parties anymore once I had left the Admiralty. And therefore, I didn't have to take the precaution of having somebody with me who was watching my back, in effect, against opiates or an injection or something like that, with truth drugs.
You were aware of these risks, though, and they were taken seriously?
Oh, yes, it was explained to me at the time. It was because I was told I could not do this, and then one said why, and then you were told why. And my predecessor in the intelligence job had left the Navy and was...
You told me that. Yeah.
Yes. That was the classic example of what could go wrong, in fact.
You didn't have any actual... You never felt under threat or were aware of any personal threat during your time?
No more than sort of the average chap who was aware that that type of threat existed. Now, I had no exciting stories of derring do as a sort of chap running away from a spy or something.
What about anti-submarine measures? I mean, I'm not sure how secret 60s things are. How far had it moved on? Perhaps it would be nice to give a little overview of it now. From your, you know, your time as a practical officer at the post.
As a practical officer, when I first went to sea, ASDIC, Anti-Submarine Detection Investigation, sea, stood for something or other, device, was just being fitted in destroyers and small ships, frigates. Some of the cruisers had them, and the exercises which were done with them at the beginning of the war were puerile in the sense that nobody really knew what the submarine tactics were, and so they were working on what had happened during the First World War as much as anything else. During the war, our appalling losses due to submarine torpedo attack on our merchant ships, and indeed some of our warships, meant that the specialists in anti-submarine warfare, who were called pingers, really played a much, much increasingly big role in setting tactics. But it wasn't until Squadron Chief Western Approaches was set up at Liverpool that the some of the escort group commanders started to use their initiative and develop new tactics to defend the Atlantic convoys, because we were actually losing the war at sea, and therefore we were losing this particular battle, and they had to do something about it. And brave men like Walker and so on really achieved miracles. By the time I became personally involved in what these gadgets could do, in Tata, in the first case, it was fairly primitive. Tata was primarily a gunship and a torpedo ship, although we carried quite a lot of depth charges and an ASDIC set. We were not really concerned to develop new anti-submarine tactics. We were very much under the control of the big ships on the screen. And their ideas of anti-submarine warfare were primitive. I've read, since the war, several books about this, and it would appear that the weight of the naval development went into gunnery warfare to improve the quality of the fleet, which had been, after all, blown up in heaps at Jutland. And I think they were rerunning those thoughts for a very long time indeed. So that my anti-submarine course as a sub-lieutenant lasted only half the time as my gunnery course, which was, in the light of my knowledge now, was surprising. The detection range of these ASDIC devices, now called sonar, because it was the American title for it when we gave it to them, was very small. You might let it run for 2,000 yards, the ping, before you sent another ping out, but whether or not the sound waves actually went to a submarine at 200-foot depth at that range depended upon the temperature gradients in the water and the amount of quenching there was, bubbles of air around the dome. If you were bouncing about in the sea, then air got under the hull and would stop the noise going out, or indeed the echoes coming back. And the skill required to differentiate between shoals of fish and rocks on the bottom and everything else under the sun was a great art. And those who really became very good at it indeed were not normally the fleet destroyers. They were the corvettes and the people escorting the Atlantic convoys. As I became a specialist in this game, by then we'd begun to take on board the lessons of the war and to realize how very bad we'd been at this. And vast expense was being, money was being poured into developing new forms of detection underwater. And huge research programs were going on, most of which occurred at the Underwater Countermeasures and Weapons Establishment in Portsmouth and the Underwater Detection Establishment at Portland. This was interesting because the Russians were well aware that the UDE, Underwater Detection Establishment at Portland, was a prime target. And when I was serving down there, I was aware of the importance of this target, and as I was in the school taking sailors to sea or officers to sea every day in ships, I was very aware, although I was not aware of just how secret some of the stuff was. Russians knew a great deal about more about it than I did. And when I got up to the intelligence department, I became aware of a most marvelous intelligence coup which the Russians had had. They had bought one of the Englishmen working in the underwater detection establishment via a girl in the establishment. And he had obtained some very important papers which he was going to hand over to his control in London. The MI5, and for all I know MI6, but MI5 certainly, became aware that this chap was actually going to meet his control in London in a certain day, in a certain place. And they wanted to track him all the way. So one lot tracked him from the underwater detection establishment to the station. Another lot were on board the train to follow him up in the train. When he got to the other end, they followed him through London, and they knew where the meeting was going to take place. And a very senior police officer was there in plain clothes, ready to do this. And just as they were coming round the corner where they were going to meet these two people and hand over the goods, somebody saw the police officer, a barrow boy, saw the police officer, and started to shout Scarpa, because he was selling illegal things from his barrow. And the policeman, seeing this man running round the corner and likely to spoil the whole of the operation, flung himself at him in a rugger tackle and brought him down in the street, put his hand firmly over his mouth and said, "Shut up and I'll let you go." "Oh, God." And he let him go. And the meeting took place, and they were caught handing it over. So we found the Russian spy, which had been a sleeper here for years and years and years, with the micro dot equipment and everything else. And we also had this stupid ex-something or other man, who was the chap who'd put his hand on it in return for money. It was a brilliant exercise, but it underlined for me how important the Russians thought it was. And, of course, in the light of the nuclear submarines being developed and of the anti-ballistic missiles in submarines, the Polaris, so on, it was quite obviously crucial and came right up to the top of the intelligence on the one hand and the development work on the other. And the man responsible as chief of staff to the head of the Polaris mission was, in fact, a man, a friend of mine, who had joined the Navy with me, Ray McCaig.
Now, what about what were these secrets, unless they're still secret? What developments had taken place since the end of the war?
The new thinking or the research which had gone into it enabled people to experiment with different frequencies of transmission, and the propagation of different frequencies underwater in different temperature conditions, thermoclines and so on, enabled much greater ranges to be obtained. And I think much of the work came from looking at how whales communicated. We've now heard on the television, radio, the squeaking of whales underwater, apparently talking to each other, sometimes hundreds of miles apart, a very long distance apart. And the whales were doing that of finding a sound channel in the water to do it in. And it was possible, for using what the whales did, to begin to explore how we could exploit those sound channels, both to detect noisy transmissions. For example, early Russian submarines were extraordinarily noisy. Or perhaps to use very high-powered but low-frequency transmissions in order to get an active range on something at a long distance. This has gone a great deal further, of course, as you would imagine, since then, I'm sure, and I'm not party to it anyway, so I don't know. But we are still, I think, working from first principles in the state where one of the major threats of nuclear warfare does not come from aeroplanes, it still comes from submarines.
So that's one part of the advance, was in detection devices, both sound and sonar, you know.
Well, so, yeah.
What about the new tactics and weapons to be used against submarines?
These vary enormously, and at the time when I knew anything much about it, they were pretty primitive. The whole story depends on how quickly you can get a weapon to the place where you think there is a submarine. So it's related to the accuracy of the knowledge of the range and bearing of the submarine, the depth of the submarine, and how quickly your weapon can leave you or leave an aeroplane and get to the place where the submarine is. And then, is it quick enough in the water to catch up a submarine? The developments of the submarines themselves meant that very large vessels, 12, 13, 18,000 ton submarines, going at 20 to 30 knots at very great depth, are extraordinarily difficult to catch, because making any weapon go through the water at that speed is very difficult. I mean, the old torpedoes that we had may be doing 35 or 40 knots. But they wouldn't get near one of these submarines unless they happened to be dropped very, very close to it indeed, and even then they'd be lucky. So it was development of weapon systems which, in effect, instead of pushing a depth charge and letting it drop down to the, and your time of flight was the sinking rate of the depth charge, at one point we were having rocket-driven devices which flew through the air at one point and then dived into the sea and became torpedoes. That, too, I'm sure, is old hat now, but I've been out of this business for a very, very long time, and I don't pretend to be up to date with it now.
But that's where it was when you left.
Where it was going when I left, and the rest is the sort of thing one reads about and dreams about and wonders if it's true.
Now, what about the setup at the underground headquarters? What was it like?
I felt just like a bottle of old port at Northwood, in the same way I did under the Admiralty in the Citadel. You rang up to find out whether it was raining when you came up to have a breath of fresh air. It was closer to home at Northwood than I'd ever been before in my whole naval career. Amazing. 5 minutes walk from the headquarters to where I lived.
What was it like? And I mean, how big was it? And what was the sort of...
We had a large number of people underneath in peacetime. We could have had a lot more in wartime, if necessary. But we had large rooms. I suspect that it was sufficiently far underneath to deal with maybe the earlier sorts of atom bomb, but I wonder very much, with hindsight, whether it was capable of withstanding the even bigger bombs, which no doubt were targeted on it.
Would you go down by lift?
No, we went down by stairs in that particular one. There were lifts in, under the Citadel, which I think was deeper than Northwood. But Northwood was built originally, I think, to withstand bombing during the war as Coastal Command headquarters. It was a strange life, but not unlike being down below in a ship. Because down below in a ship, you've got no windows, you've got no daylight, you've got air coming through trunking, and this was much the same as then.
Now, were you aware of this block on your promotion?
Until I was passed over. And passed over at Northwood.
How did you find out?
I wasn't promoted. There was a zone within which one was promoted, and there came a stage in the proceedings when I found I had not been promoted. And
did you know why at the time?
No, nobody said why. You know, bad luck, old boy. You know, happens to a lot of us. That's about all there was to it.
And what was your immediate reaction? Because you did take.
There is
one more posting you took, so.
Oh, yes, there was one more posting I took in the Admiralty while I was making up my mind what to do about it. I think distress. I was very disappointed. I was ambitious. And this rubbed off on the whole family. I don't normally conceal what I'm feeling anyway. And the family knew about it. I went to see my chief of staff at Northwood. and said I was very worried indeed, and could he give me any advice, find out anything? And broadly speaking, the answer was no, he couldn't. This must have been associated with earlier reports, which he was not privy to. And that meant to me that my one chance as a wet list commander, that's to say I was entitled to command a ship, available for appointment to command a ship, I had been judged while at sea in Belfast, and that was the only sea job I'd had while I was in the zone for promotion.